Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Good evening tonight. What happens next after a weekend that saw the Biden administration and the Federal Reserve scramble to intervene in the failure of two banks, both with deep ties to the tech industry? The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in the Bay Area and Signature Bank here in New York shook customers and investors alike. The question was, and really still is, would it also threaten the broader market and the banking system? So far, the answer appears to be no. Markets largely held steady, closing the day mixed, though shares in regional banks, similar to the ones that failed, did take a beating. Joining us shortly, former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, who accurately predicted the current high inflation, to walk us through the coming days and weeks and what he thinks about the federal response so far, including this promise from the president.
Every American should feel confident that their deposits will be there if and when they need them.
In addition to Secretary Summers, we have seen as Christine Romans and Phil Mattingly on this tonight. Christine on Your Money and Phil on the White House response to what comes next. We begin with Christine. So is the threat of contagion in the financial markets, is that seems to have passed?
So for this bank, these two banks in particular, they've put a big ring around these banks and they've stopped the fire here. And they have made essentially the depositors whole. And these are people who would have to go and make payroll. These are small businesses. So the White House really concerned about making sure the depositors are made whole. But the shareholders in those banks get nothing, right? I mean, this is not a bailout of the bank. It's a bailout of the people who deposited in that bank. But we looked at these regional banks today, a really tough day for some of these regional banks. There are still some big concerns.
With their stock prices.
Their stock prices came down very, very sharply. You can see some of them there on your screen. Some of these were, they halted trading of some of these because it was just so fast and furious, the selling here. And what's happening is investors are looking at some of these banks and saying, do they have a similar kind of profile as some of the banks that have failed? And what kinds of things do they have on their books that may be a little less valuable today? So I think it's going to be some bumpy going here in the banking industry in the near term.
Yeah, I mean, what should we be looking for in the coming days and weeks?
Well, I think the biggest thing to watch for is what the Federal Reserve is going to do. It was a week ago, Anderson, that the Fed chief Jerome Powell signaled maybe there'd be 50 basis points of another rate hike and we needed to get inflation under control. And then suddenly you have three banks actually in the past week break, essentially. So are they worried about the fragility of the banking system and being able to handle more rate hikes in this environment, in some of the far corners of banking? And I think that the going assumption now is the Fed might go more slowly. And in fact, put the fight against inflation on pause while it makes sure that the financial system is truly, truly stable.
Interesting. Christine Romans, appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah. Now to the White House and CNN's Phil Mattingly. What is the White House's plan, Phil?
You know, Anderson, I think there's really two key components. There's obviously the policy component. We saw dramatic emergency authorities rolled out on Sunday night, and Treasury officials, bank regulators have been watching the effect of those efforts throughout the course of this day, on the phone constantly with regulators in these financial institutions, with bank CEOs as well, trying to ensure that they are having the desired effect. And while Christine pointed out, those regional banks were getting hammered in the equity markets. Behind the scenes, I'm told they were seeing some positive signs as it relates to deposits. Obviously, depositors and the risks that they faced were a critical concern here, mostly on the rationale of panic. They were concerned that there would be significant and dramatic depositor outflows from some of these banks. They have seen those outflows start to slow, which they view as a positive signal. The other key element here is access to credit, ensuring that these banks can stay liquid, even if they're getting hit by the market, long enough to maintain some level of durability and sustainability going forward. They've seen some of that as well, tied to the Federal Reserve's credit lending facility. So some positive signs going forward on that front. The other, obviously, is messaging. The president making very clear that he wanted to reassure individuals, reassure small businesses, trying to make clear what his regulators and finance officials are saying, that the market on the whole is stable and well capitalized. They need that to be believed, obviously, to ensure there's no panic that carries out further.
Is the White House concerned about any political ramifications of this for them?
They're keenly aware that there are there is political fallout that is coming. They've been watching and waiting for Republicans to kind of jump on this. You've seen a few of the kind of mid-tier presidential candidates like Nikki Haley start to jump on this, call this a Biden bailout. But in talking to White House officials, they have moved very quickly to try and get in front of that. You saw that in the president's remarks, blaming the deregulation in the 2018 law signed by President Trump for some of the effects here. Also making clear in as declarative a manner as possible that this is dramatically different from the 2008 financial crisis. One White House official I spoke to said this: nobody thinks we're out of the woods here, but we're picking up clear signals that the scale and breadth of what we deployed is having an effect. We're not going to sit back and let Republicans beat the hell out of us for protecting small business owners and individuals, and we're not going to let anyone act like this is 2008 when our actions are designed to ensure the exact opposite is true. And I think that's a critical component here. You talk to White House officials, they make clear the president's focus here was on those depositors, on those small businesses, and making clear that the executives at these banks, like Silicon Valley Bank, like Signature Bank, were no longer employed, that they did not have major golden parachutes coming out of this as well, and also that there will be accountability going forward. The president mentioning all of those things today, that wasn't by accident. That is very clearly a message that they want to get across here, very much so predicting the political fallout that'll be coming in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, Phil Mattingly, appreciate it from the White House tonight. As promised, we're joined now by Lawrence Summers, who served as Treasury Secretary during the Clinton administration and as Director of the National Economic Council in the Obama White House in the wake of the 2008 banking crisis. Secretary Summers, it's good to see you. For those wondering tonight if the country is out of the woods on this, what do you say?
Look, I think that Americans should feel safe that the money they have deposited in banks is going to be there for them. And that's the most important thing. And I think that assurance was given for the banks that were closed very directly by the federal government last night. And I think the facility, the provisions that were made to lend money on very large scales to other banks were designed to assure that come what may, they would be able to take care of their depositors. And so I think that's the most important thing that has happened here. And I think that's a very important success.
Of course,
there are issues that lie ahead.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, we saw the stock market close at a relatively stable level today, aside from some of the regional bank stocks with Christine talked about. For average investors, what should they read into it? What do you think lies ahead?
Look, I think we have a complicated economy because of inflation and because there are risks of recession that are ahead. But I think it's a little bit more complicated, but not vastly more complicated than it was before these problems came to us. I think it's very important that the Fed continue to do what's necessary to contain inflation. They're going to have to make some difficult judgments. No question but that events like this are likely to mean that the banking system is a bit less forthcoming with new loans. And that's a kind of monetary tightening. And because that's happening, the Fed may need to tighten less than it otherwise would have. But I certainly think the Fed needs to stay focused on the inflation challenge. That is really what the American people have said is what they see as our principal economic challenge. And I think it's what history teaches us, that if we don't keep inflation controlled, we ultimately have much larger recessions and much more suffering.
So should this slow the Fed down in terms of raising rates, or should they continue on the same course?
I think that many people were talking about the idea, and Chairman Powell clearly broached the idea, although he certainly didn't commit to it, that at its next meeting in about 10 days, the Fed should raise rates by 50 basis points, by half a percentage point. I think that looks like a much lower likelihood right now in light of the various concerns that are out there that this will slow the economy. And I think it's premature to try to judge what the Fed should do. We're going to get an important data point about inflation tomorrow, an important data point about retail sales the day after that. And we're going to see how these financial measures work through. But I'd be disappointed if the Fed, which very clearly was on a path to raising interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point and then probably doing it again, if the Fed wasn't able to raise rates by a quarter of a percentage point because of all of this, I would be surprised and I would be a bit disappointed. But again, it's very difficult to judge the future, and the Fed will know much more when it has to vote on that interest rate policy than it does right now.
Senator Bernie Sanders has said that he thinks the failure of SVB was the direct result of the previous administration loosening financial regulations. Is there a truth to that? Do you agree with that?
I think that the decisions that were made during the previous administration to exempt some mid-sized banks from some categories of regulation, for example, were misguided, and many said so at the time. I do think that this is a current and ongoing failure of regulation, that these problems, which in retrospect look rather obvious, were not caught in advance, because if they had been caught in advance, there are various adjustments that could have been made that might have avoided them. So yes, the changes in rules are a problem, but frankly, the ongoing process of regulation, I think, is going to need to be reviewed quite closely.
Yeah, Secretary Lawrence Summers, I really appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the former president in Iowa tonight and what he is saying potentially just days away from a criminal indictment. And later, how a top Tennessee elected official reconciles supporting anti-gay legislation with his online sending of hearts and flame emojis to a young, scantily clad gay man ahead. Former president is making his first trip to Iowa of the 2024 campaign, and perhaps just days before a criminal indictment in the Stormy Daniels hush money case. Before arriving, he told reporters he blamed January 6th, quote, in many ways, end quote, on his former vice president. And speaking tonight in Davenport, where potential rival Ron DeSantis spoke on Friday, he had this to say about the Florida governor.
Ron DeSantis. Did anyone ever hear of DeSantis? DeSanctimonious. Ron was a disciple of Paul Ryan, who is a rhino loser who currently is destroying Fox. Ron reminds me a lot of Mitt Romney.
Some perspective now on the campaign. The campaigner in chief, CNN chief correspondent, and CNN This Morning co-anchor, Caitlin Collins. She, of course, covered the Trump White House as well. Again, it's remarkable how backward looking the former president is in his comments in what he's talking about, blaming Mike Pence for January 6th.
Yeah, he's been complaining about the press coverage that Pence has been getting since Saturday night. I was in the room when Pence actually made this comment.
That was at the gridiron dinner. No cameras were around.
No cameras allowed. We'll get to that in a minute, because that is a criticism they're pushing back on. But Pence did take this moment where typically it's just, you know, laughing, making fun of other political rivals. He was doing that at the beginning, and he made some Trump jokes, but then he got serious about January 6th. And he did go further than he's gone before. He's criticized what happened that day. But saying that he does believe history will hold Trump accountable was very notable. Taking that stance, going that far as to say about how Trump's words endangered Pence, endangered everybody who was at the Capitol. Pence was also really critical of Fox News, which I thought was remarkable, because we have not seen him. He was going after one of the biggest hosts on Fox and saying that the way that they portrayed what happened on January 6th with that 40,000 hours of footage that they reviewed, he said was it mocks decency to portray it that way, because it wasn't just sightseeing. It wasn't just tourism. Trump has been unhappy with that. And so today on the plane to Iowa, where he's speaking now, he was saying that because Pence didn't do what he wanted that day, actually, he's responsible for the violence that happened. That is the exact same argument that John Eastman, who was that attorney at the time of January 6th, in and out of the Oval Office, emailed to Pence's attorney that day, his counsel, Greg Jacob. He emailed and said, actually,
while they were in hiding, while they were at the Capitol.
Yeah, the riot's still going on. Right. And he emails and says, actually, you're responsible for this siege and what happened, because basically you guys didn't let this happen in public, sending these votes back to the state legislatures. And so it's not surprising that Trump is saying this, but I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that he's unhappy with the coverage Pence has gotten about.
I got to say, I read an email you sent out which had the response by Pence's guy back to John Eastman while they were in hiding at the Capitol. And it was just grace under fire and just a very effective response to John Eastman, essentially saying, you have been pushing a completely bogus legal argument and you bear responsibility for riling up all these people who are now attacking the Capitol.
Yeah, and I think they knew how Trump worked. And so I think the phrase that Greg Jacob used that I won't forget was he said that they were a serpent in the ear of Trump, basically pushing these theories, saying that Pence could do something that Pence legally could not do. Pence actually had attorneys look into this at the time. And so it's just remarkable that we're here. I think on the timing of Pence saying this, you know, it was behind closed doors. It wasn't on camera. It was on the record, but it wasn't on camera. He is fighting a subpoena from the DOJ to come and testify in the special counsel's investigation into January 6th. He did not go testify before the January 6th committee. He did write about January 6th and the conversations in his book. I think a lot of this has to do with political timing. I mean, the 2024 field is shaping up. And what Pence has done by going out this far to say that Trump will be held accountable that day is every other 2024 candidate is going to get asked about this now and if they agree or where their stance is. And so he's kind of, you know, setting a standard there.
It's interesting, though, because, I mean, he was on a book tour. He, you know, he's had plenty of opportunities before this to say stuff on camera, and he has chosen not to.
He's been critical of it. He has not gone as far as to say Trump will be held accountable for that day. I mean, in the room, it was a lot of reporters in the room. It got very quiet as he was saying that, because it wasn't even just that. He was also very laudatory of the press, talking about how good our coverage was that day and what it meant as they were under siege. You know, they were still being hidden, he and his security and his family who was with him that day. He was very he praised the press a lot. And that was something that stood out. Obviously, we've seen how
Do that on camera. Interesting.
Doesn't do it on camera. So there's not that moment where you can replay it. I mean, right. I still think the comment has gotten a ton of attention, but
it's not the same.
Yeah.
Does the Trump campaign feel like they are well positioned given the rivals that, I mean, they're, because now, you know, there were a lot of Republicans saying, well, look, there can't be a repeat of 2016 where you had all these potential candidates on a debate stage with Trump and he's picking them off one by one. That's what is being set up right now.
Well, we'll see how big it is. I'm kind of surprised, actually, that more people have not gotten in the race so far. DeSantis, it's rumored to be waiting until after the legislature ends. Pence has not gotten in yet. Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy are the only two people who are actually formally challenging him so far. Obviously, others are going to get in, but you see people like Larry Hogan, who's not getting in, right. A very popular governor of Maryland. And he said today that, you know, now he views his role in 2024 as just single-handedly making sure Trump is not the nominee. I think for the Trump campaign, I just was talking to someone in Trump's world last week. They're very worried about Ron DeSantis. That's the reason he spent so much of these remarks in Iowa, where DeSantis just was on Friday going after him and criticizing him and saying, you know, he's bad on ethanol, but if he doesn't run, I'll say he's not bad on ethanol. They're very worried about him. Donors are not committing to Trump. His former staffers, people like Sarah Sanders, are declining to endorse him yet. I think they are watching all of that really closely.
Collins, thank you. Appreciate it. Now, perhaps a sign the former president might find this latest campaign tougher going than his other two, as Caitlin was just referencing. It can be found in Roberts County in the Texas Panhandle, most heavily pro-Trump county in 2016 and 2020. Perhaps, though, not this time. Gary Tuchman returned there tonight to see what, if anything, has changed.
The county seat of tiny Roberts County, Texas, is pronounced Miami. It would also be fair to pronounce it as America's number one county for Donald Trump.
So who do you think you'll vote for in the next presidential election?
Trump.
In this county of about 800 people, he received 95% of the vote in 2016, 96% in 2020, both times the highest percentage of any county in the nation. But is Trumpism on track for continued success here?
I just think it's time to move on.
This is our fourth visit here since Trump was elected president. And on this visit, there is a notable shift. Ron Swart and his wife Kay are retired and live on a hilltop ranch in the county. They and everyone else we interviewed for this story say they voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020.
If the Republican presidential primary were today, do you know who you would vote for?
Probably DeSantis, possibly Pence, but definitely not Trump.
And your husband?
DeSantis, more likely.
It quickly became clear to us that many Donald Trump voters here are ready for a different Republican.
I'm leaning toward Nikki Haley, but...
How come?
Because I like her views and the way she does things.
If you had a vote today, who would you pick?
Probably Pence.
Wade Jackson has lived in Miami his whole life. He's in the oil and gas business, also collects antique cars and does mechanic work. And he warns any potential intruder, he's not calling 911. He's a lifelong conservative Republican who's not shy about criticizing the man he voted for twice.
He's done some shady things that I'm not real fond of right now, so I want to see if there's something else better than that.
What kind of shady things?
Well, like all the documents and stuff in Mar-a-Lago and all of that. I think he's hidden too much stuff. We don't need that in our country. We need everything on the table out in the open.
Rick McDowell operates a hunting business. We interviewed the strong Trump supporter during one of our previous visits to Miami. But he now says that in next year's Texas primary, he's planning to vote for Ron DeSantis.
Donald Trump likes loyal people. Why aren't you being loyal to him and supporting him again?
I think his time's over. I think he's got too much baggage.
Trump certainly still has enthusiastic supporters in Roberts County.
So I'm going to stay loyal, and I will stay
You have no issues with the way he conducted himself during his presidency?
No.
I'd like them to run together. And that'd be
Trump
good.
Trump DeSantis.
Trump DeSantis.
Who would you want to be the president? Who would you want to be the vice president?
That'd be good. I don't know. I think DeSantis might could get elected more easy. Trump's got a lot of people that hate him.
All in all, it does appear Donald Trump has some challenges here. New challenges.
I voted for him originally because I was really voting against Hillary. And then I was voting against Biden. And then I thought he might be good for the country. But he's done a lot of disturbing things that are not good for the country. And I don't think, yes, and I don't think he's what we want representing us, who we want representing us.
What disturbing in your mind?
The Capitol and his...
The insurrection.
Yes, and the comments he makes, you know, they're just not professional.
How do you feel? Do you agree with your wife?
I agree 100%, yes, sir.
And Gary Tuckman joins us now from Roberts County, Texas. First of all, it looks beautiful there. Did any of the people who are skeptical of the former president that you spoke to, did they say they'd consider voting for a Democrat if Trump is the GOP nominee? Would they go that far?
The answer is no, Anderson. Nobody I talked to who's become disenchanted with Donald Trump gave any indication they would go that far. And I got a pointed answer from that couple on the ranch. A ranch that's been in their family for more than 100 years, by the way. I asked them specifically, would you even consider voting for Joe Biden if Donald Trump were the Republican presidential nominee? And the husband, Ron Sort, answered me. His answer was, quote, I'd never, ever vote Democrat. Anderson?
Well, he knows where he stands. Gary Tuckman, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Just ahead, why was Tennessee's 79-year-old Republican lieutenant governor, who has in the past supported anti-gay legislation, sending heart and fire emojis and other messages to a 20-year-old gay man who posts sexually provocative photos online? He sat down with a local reporter to explain.
I try to encourage people with posts and try to, help them if I can.
Earlier this month, Tennessee's Republican-led government made the state the first in the nation this year to restrict drag performances in front of children. The state also has banned gender-affirming care for minors, including puberty blockers and hormone therapies. And now the lieutenant governor, a 79-year-old Republican, is trying to explain why he's been sending heart emojis and fire emojis and other messages to a 20-year-old gay man who posts provocative pictures of himself online. Randy Kaye has details.
Really sorry.
Tennessee's Lieutenant Governor Randy McNally, a Republican and supporter of anti-LGBTQ legislation, apologizing for his repeated interactions with a young gay man who posts provocative photos on Instagram. The progressive website, The Tennessee Holler, first unearthed McNally's interactions with 20-year-old Franklin McClure, who goes by Franklin Superstar on social media. In many of McClure's posts, he's scantily clad, often pulling his shorts slightly down. Among the posts the 79-year-old lieutenant governor reacted to, this close-up of McClure's backside. McNally responded with three red hearts and three fire emojis, then commented, "You can turn a rainy day into rainbows and sunshine." McNally declined our interview request, but spoke with our affiliate, WTVF.
Try to encourage people with posts and try to, help them if I can.
How exactly his heart and fire emojis were helping Franklin McClure is still unclear. WTVF also asked the lieutenant governor specifically about liking this post, where McClure used language such as prostitute and referred to his sexual act.
It was liked by Lieutenant Governor McNally.
Yeah. I don't know that, you know, a lot of times on people's posts, you see the name and you see what they've written and you just press the button that says like.
So you didn't read that post?
I don't recall reading the part about the weed. I know that.
Well, what about the prostitute?
I might have read that.
In that case, was it appropriate to like the comment?
Probably not.
On my end,
Franklin McClure told me the lieutenant governor has been commenting on his post for several years. On this post, McNally responded with a hand clap emoji, along with the comment, super look. On this one, McNally left a heart emoji. In this one, showing McClure dancing outside in his underwear, the lieutenant governor left a comment saying, love it, with pink hearts.
Roll call, Ms. McClure.
There's certainly nothing illegal or inherently wrong about any of that, but there is hypocrisy, rank hypocrisy. That's because at the time Lieutenant Governor McNally was commenting on McClure's posts, he and his fellow Republicans in the Tennessee legislature were passing a slew of bills targeting LGBTQ people, or what critics call the slate of hate.
I was not very kind to that community. As I learned some things and met some people in that community, I realized that they're still individuals and they still have value.
Just recently, the governor here signed into law a bill that outlaws drag shows in public property and another that bars transgender children from getting gender-affirming health care. Democratic State Senator Heidi Campbell.
I think it's problematic if you support legislation that takes away freedom and rights of our LGBTQ community, and yet you are participating in behavior that obviously, shows that you have interest in that area.
In all, Tennessee's legislature has more than two dozen bills proposed by Republican lawmakers that limit the rights of those in the LGBTQ community.
Lieutenant Governor, can I get a
We tried to ask Lieutenant Governor McNally about all of this at the Capitol in Nashville.
What do you say to folks who are calling you a hypocrite? What do you say to folks who say you're a hypocrite?
I think it's in the press release.
Local reporters confronted McNally earlier when news of this first broke, and he pushed back.
I'm not anti-gay. I also have friends that are gay, relatives that are gay.
Meanwhile, Franklin McClure, the young man in the images liked by McNally, told me he was surprised and flattered by the lieutenant governor's comments. He also told me this.
He called me a couple times on the phone ability on certain apps.
And you never responded to those?
Yeah, I didn't even know he did it, so.
Why would he be calling you?
I don't know.
I've embarrassed my family, embarrassed my friends, embarrassed any of the members of the legislature with the post. It was not my intent to, and not my intent to hurt them.
And Randy joins us now from Nashville. So you tried to speak with Lieutenant Governor today. He said something about a statement. What did it say?
Yeah, he did issue a statement to us, Anderson. It was quite a long statement, so I'll just give you a few of the key parts. He said that he is pausing his social media and will be getting guidance on how to use it. He also insisted that this characterization of him and his record as anti-gay is inaccurate in that statement of his. And he also said that every person has value and deserves respect regardless of orientation. But Anderson, as you know, this statement comes as he continues to push through this anti-gay legislation. In fact, just today on the Senate floor, they were debating a biological sex bill while we were there waiting for the lieutenant governor and trying to speak with him. Also, Franklin McClure, that the young man who he had been commenting on Instagram, told me that the hypocrisy in all of this was not lost on him either. He said that he's watching him leave these very nice comments on his Instagram, yet he's continuing to push through this anti-LGBTQ legislation, and he sees that as very hypocritical, Anderson.
Randy Kaye, appreciate it. Thanks. Coming up, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says talk of a Florida book ban is a hoax. Best-selling author Jodi Picco, who has sold millions of books, says 20 of her works were recently targeted and removed from library shelves in one Florida county school system. One of those books about the Holocaust. She joins us next. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was adamant last week that recent state regulations on school libraries did not lead to book bans on seemingly innocuous works. He called that a, quote, hoax. Yet earlier that week, local media in Martin County, Florida, published a list of books being removed from school libraries. Those books included Beloved by Toni Morrison, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. They also included works by Judy Blume, James Patterson, and my next guest, Jodi Picco. The best-selling author is speaking out, saying that 20 of her books have been removed by officials in Martin County schools, including House Rules, My Sister's Keeper, and The Storyteller. Jodi Picco joins me now for her first TV interview on the subject. Her most recent book is Mad Honey. Jodi, thank you so much for being with us. Can you just explain your understanding of why some of your books have been taken off the shelves? I mean, how does that actually happen?
So in Martin County School District, you do not actually have to read the books to challenge them. And you do not even have to say what is objectionable in a book to have it removed from a shelf. And this is actually true in a lot of Florida. So it's worth saying that although 20 of my books happen to be removed this time, this is happening all over Florida and the rest of the country, and most of the people who are affected as authors are BIPOC and LGBTQ authors. From what I understand, the objection to my books is that they were classified by this one parent as adult romance, which is very interesting because I do not write adult romance. And in fact, of the books that were challenged, one of them is a book called The Storyteller, which is about the Holocaust and about the rise of fascism among ordinary Germans. And there's not even a kiss in that book. So I was quite confused. And, you know, it just felt a little ironic, actually, that that was one of the books banned here.
You said, I mean, 20 of your books were pulled from this one district in Florida.
Right.
Do you know why The Storyteller? I mean, if it's about the Holocaust, obviously it's a difficult subject. You know, it's an emotional subject. Was there something that you can really identify that would have made it somebody objected?
No, and I think that's the point. You know, the laws that currently stand in Florida are so egregious and so vague that books are being pulled off shelves without a lot of understanding why, without reason. And what's most important to remember is that these books remain off the shelves while they are being reviewed, if they are being reviewed. And that can take years. It can take a very long time in some cases.
In addition to being a writer, you are also a parent. You're now, I just learned, a grandparent. Congratulations on that.
I am
a relatively new parent as well.
Yeah.
You know, obviously I have concerns about what my kids are going to be reading. I have concerns about what they're going to be seeing on television. All of that you understand. What is the line here that makes this, in your opinion, unacceptable?
You're a parent. I'm a parent. As parents, it's totally fine to make a decision about what your child can or cannot read. It is not fine for you to make a decision for everyone else's child. And that is really what's at heart here. That is what the problem is here. And I think it's also really important that America realize, no matter what you're hearing, this is not a hoax. It's not a hoax to the authors whose books are being pulled off shelves. And it is not a hoax to the kids who can't access titles that they want to read.
The governor has, Governor DeSantis has said that this is about curriculum transparency. Do you believe that?
I don't believe that, because if it was, then challenging a book should require you to read the book, to know what's in the book, and to have a reason for wanting it off the shelves.
Parents are challenging books they haven't read. In some cases, there are national organizations which are sending out lists of books to communities that parents should be concerned about, and parents can take that list to their school board or their principal and have those books questioned.
And that is what happened in the case in Martin County. It is a mom, one mom in particular, who did the bulk of the banning of 92 books. And she works with Moms for Liberty, which is a national organization, and she is part of the local chapter in Martin County. And I have seen the actual forms that she filled out where she checked a box saying, no, I have not read this book in its entirety.
Your books are interesting. I mean, you don't shy away from difficult topics and kind of different perspectives in a lot of your stories. They're very human stories, but they are, you know, you have a book, right. 19 Minutes, I think it's called, which deals with the aftermath of a school shooting. Obviously, these are things which are important topics and topics that can spark conversations between a parent and a child.
That's how I raised my kids. You know, when my kids wanted to read a book that I thought might be challenging or emotionally confusing for them at whatever age they were, I would read the book, make sure that I felt it was appropriate, and then use it as a springboard for discussion. And I think that's really important. I don't actually write adult romance. There isn't stuff in my books that would be considered vulgar. What I do write about are topics like racism and gun control and gay rights and abortion rights, things that make kids learn how to think for themselves, which last time I checked was actually the job of public education in America.
What is the big picture problem here? What is the big picture concern for you here beyond your books, beyond that just this principle, why does this matter?
The reason this matters is because we have scientific proof that kids who feel marginalized, who read books that have characters that are marginalized, feel less alone. And we know also that kids who haven't met or experienced people who are different from them, who do so in the safe space of a book, also learn about those cultures and those identities. We know that books bridge divides between people, and we know that book bans create them. And that ultimately is the big problem here. Kids are not getting information that they literally have a Supreme Court right to have. There was a case in 1982 where, you know, the Supreme Court decided that based on the First Amendment, kids have the right to receive information, and it can't be removed from shelves because of political reasons. And yet here we are with a state that keeps pulling books off shelves without a really good explanation of why or a plan for how to get them back on the shelves in a timely fashion. And that's a real problem.
What do you encourage people to do about this?
I encourage them to speak out as loudly as the people who are making the noise, because there are far more people who don't want books banned in this country than the ones that do. And so I encourage them to go to pen.org/action. You can find resources there that will help you join a rally or go up to a school board or write letters or find a way to become involved in your own community or other communities. And that's really what we have to do. We have to start speaking out.
Jodi Picco, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course.
Up next, March Madness, which lots of people in my office talk about, and I still don't quite understand what it is or why we're expected to fill out brackets. Luckily, Harry Anton will be here to explain it all and help you with brackets, whatever that means. Well, college basketball fans do not need me to tell them it's March Madness time. And if they do, that's pretty sad because I don't know what it is and I can't even muster up the energy to learn. Luckily, our senior data reporter, Harry Anton, is mad about March Madness, has some tips for filling out those brackets. Okay, what is it? What's the point?
So first, I want to give you your own bracket here.
Thank you.
I come bearing gifts, and we're going to fill this out a little.
I always, when people walk around the office, like, oh, do you want to do a bracket? I'm just like, no. Thanks.
But we're going to fill this out after the segment. Okay. You know, there are 63 games.
There are a lot of teams.
There are 64 teams. Well, there's 68, but 64 that make it to the round of 64. You're going to have to pick 63 games. But I just want to get an understanding, Anderson, of your level of understanding. So on this, we're going to have the logos up for the four number one seeds, okay. And I want to see if you can actually know any of these teams. Can you name any of these teams, Anderson?
The bird is Kansas?
Yes, okay, yes. That's
KU.
One.
Yes,
KU.
I knew someone went there.
Yes.
University of Hawaii?
Ooh, University of Houston, but that's okay. Not bad. They both have H's in it.
That was a dumb guess. The script A, I don't know, the Atlanta Astros.
Caitlin would be very upset with you right now.
Alabama.
Alabama.
And the P is for
Pittsburgh? No, it's for Purdue. It's for Purdue. So you were able to
KU.
Get one.
I got KU.
Yeah, you got KU. So not bad. You're not off to a bad start.
So how many people fill out a bracket before the tournament starts, and how many people actually get it right?
Yeah, so
how do people, like, it's amazing to me that people would know all these teams.
They don't. There are millions upon millions. You know, ESPN had over 17 million last year who filled it out. When you look at other brackets and combine it, we could be looking at upwards 40, 50, 60 million people who fill out brackets this year. Wouldn't surprise me. But, you know, you
I feel this is a flaw in my character that I don't know these teams. Like, I should
No. Don't worry about it.
I'd like to know who the characters are than players.
I'm here to help you. Okay. That's the purpose here.
So what tips do you have?
So hold on. I just want to note that on the perfect bracket, I wouldn't worry about it because you know how many people get the perfect bracket?
No.
Nobody gets it right. You know what the odds of getting a perfect bracket by chance are? 1 in 9 quintillion.
Wow.
Compare that to the Mega Millions, 1 in 303 million. Okay. Compare that to getting a royal flush in poker, it's 1 in 350,000.
Why am I in this graphic?
Because we are making happy things occur for you. That's what it is. I'm trying to help you understand that it's very difficult, so I wouldn't worry about filling out a perfect bracket.
Okay.
But I want to give you some clues.
Okay.
Some clues to fill it out. Here's the big thing. The number one usually wins, okay? 60% of the time, the number one ends up winning the entire thing. So there are four number one seeds that we already spoke about earlier, okay? Four number one seeds. They're the ones who get through this round, round of 64, round of 32, round of 16, round of 8, round of 4, and the final, okay? So pick one of the number one teams to win the entire thing. That, I think, is one thing. And don't worry about picking the early games necessarily correctly, because the truth is most bracket tournaments give you a lot more points. You get a lot more reward for picking those later games.
Okay. I went to my special place a long time ago.
I am always in my own special place, Anderson. So I'll join you in your special place.
I lost you at the number one thing. Sorry.
You always lose me.
You can help me fill this out later.
Don't worry. We'll fill it out and we'll come back and we'll check in a few weeks.
Good luck, everybody, with your brackets. You can get more March Madness insight tomorrow night when Chris Wallace talks with new NCAA president Charlie Baker in his first TV interview since taking over the organization. It'll also be a lot of fun with former NBA player and TNT host Kenny Smith, as well as outgoing Syracuse coach Jim Boeheim. Don't miss CNN Primetime Inside the Madness, Basketball Brackets and Business tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern. I'm glad they didn't have me doing it because I would have messed it up. We'll be right back. According to new reports, for the first time, the International Criminal Court plans to open war crimes cases against Russia for its actions in Ukraine and will issue warrants for, quote, several people. New reporting is from the New York Times and Reuters. One war crimes case is reportedly prompted by Russian attacks on infrastructure, like this one targeting a Ukrainian train station last year. There's also accusations of deliberately targeting a residential building and parking lot in Kharkiv. Russia says it only hits military targets. The other case will reportedly focus on the abduction of Ukrainian children, like these so-called evacuees from war-torn eastern Ukraine shown in a Crimean summer camp. Ukraine says in a recent report from Yale University documents that thousands of kids are being taken to Russia, indoctrinated, and in many cases adopted or fostered by Russian families, which is a war crime. The news continues. Aaron Burnett out front starts now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.